Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from Florida Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit conservation organization working on behalf of Florida's fish, wildlife, and their habitats, as well as outdoor education and sustainable nature-based recreation. Florida Wildlife Federation, since 1936, fwfonline.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida House and Senate have settled on a budget deal, but the governor isn't too happy. The negotiations have been worked out in secret.
Because if I was a House or Senate member, I'd say, well, look, I want to represent my district. I can't represent my district if I'm not at the table.
Also tonight, a school choice priority of the Florida House is steaming full speed ahead, despite the opposition of traditional public school supporters.
I mean, these are kids, young kids, who are stuck in schools, not for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, but for 5 years in these failure factories.
We'll also get the latest on today's House and Senate negotiations on gambling, tax breaks for solar energy, and government-issued certificates in cases of miscarriage. I'm Tom Flanagan. 1 week and 1 day to go in this Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Just a few days ago, the sound of panic buttons being pushed in and around the Florida Capitol was almost audible. Politicians and pundits alike were mostly in agreement that any kind of budget compromise between the legislature's two chambers was next to impossible, especially with the scheduled end of session less than 2 weeks away. But there is a different sound and mood in Tallahassee today. Budget talks have begun, or at least the public face of them have started. Nick Evans reports lawmakers are planning an extremely tight timeline.
The House and Senate presiding officers have been trading offers behind closed doors for over a week, but now they're bringing their allocations out into the open.
We have reached an agreement on allocations, and budget conference will begin this afternoon.
That's Senate President Joe Negron. And he explains raises for state workers, a major priority for Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala, are tucked into the nearly $83 billion deal.
You know, based on my experience, you should never bet against the appropriations chair of the House or Senate, and you shouldn't bet against the Patriots.
And Latvala says the increase is broad.
Every group of public employees in Florida will have an increase in pay, except one, and that's us. Sorry about that.
But the backroom dealing has raised concerns among lawmakers left out of the negotiations. Still, House Speaker Richard Corcoran defends the process.
Everything that was discussed between the two chambers or between members or between the chairman or between the subcommittee chairman has been stuff that's been discussed, and you've seen it all in the open, including amendments and we've traveled this state and talked about all those things that matter to the that are priorities of the Senate and priorities of the House, and it was completely open.
It's also raising the ire of the guy who has to sign off on the final deal. Governor Rick Scott's campaign committee released a new web ad criticizing state legislators for their refusal to fund his priorities.
Florida's been winning. Now a group of politicians in Tallahassee want us to lose. That's irresponsible.
And Scott says if he was a House or Senate member, he'd be furious.
They have the same number of votes as the Speaker and the Senate President. They should be in the discussion, like, you know, just like the Speaker and the Senate President. Everybody should be there and and be part of that conversation. Because if I was a House or Senate member, I'd say, well, look, I want to represent my district. I can't represent my district if I'm not at the table.
Scott's cozy relationship with President Donald Trump likely helped the state secure an agreement to fund hospitals that treat low-income Floridians. But the governor quickly turned around and asked for money to help improve the Lake Okeechobee Dike and even more state tourism dollars than he outlined in his initial spending plan. State lawmakers have largely balked at those requests. Budget drafters are expecting to have their first pass of the budget done by noon Saturday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
For supporters, it was a critical component of expanded school choice. For opponents, it was yet one more attack on traditional public schools. Florida lawmakers appear to be moving forward with a House-driven bill boosting funding to charter schools that set up near chronically failing public schools. The measure, dubbed Schools of Hope, is a priority of House Speaker Richard Corcoran, but its final form is still being debated.
House Speaker Richard Corcoran wants to see fewer mom-and-pop schools, and he wants to see more high-performing charter networks serving Florida children in failing public schools. He believes his $200 million Schools of Hope proposal is what it's going to take to get such networks into Florida.
I mean, these are kids, young kids, who are stuck in schools, not for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, but for 5 years in these failure factories. And once you have a child that's had 5 years and they lose a grade or two grades every year, they're never going to be able to recover. And what you've robbed from those children are their dignity and hope. And we've put hundreds of millions of dollars into a program that says enough is enough. That's got to end.
The House Speaker believes the high-performing charter networks will come to serve students who may be years behind in grade levels. But the measure has been met with skepticism by Democrats, teachers, and school district officials. The Senate has voiced support, though. Maitland Republican Senator David Simmons suggests he wants to extend additional help to those failing public schools. And earlier this week, the Senate revealed its version of the plan, which does not include any language regarding struggling public schools. Senate Bill 796 is, according to the Florida Education Association's Kathy Bain,
this is just Schools of Hope with a different label, and we have concerns about that.
But there's another measure, SB 1556. That bill does address Simmons's earlier promise to traditional schools. His bill includes language that establishes an early warning system that identifies struggling students and gets them support. The measure also changes how the state deals with schools that get D or F grades. The House wants to eliminate the district-managed turnaround option and jump right into more severe interventions, like closure or conversion to private administration or student removal to other schools. But that district turnaround plan does stay in the Senate measure. And the Senate also adds and prioritizes three new options: a one-hour school day extension, a community partnership model to provide health, after-school and social services like clothing banks and food pantries, plus a principal autonomy program that gives greater leeway to principals to hire and fire personnel. Senate Appropriations Chairman Jack Latvala says both of those bills are setting the chamber up to negotiate with the House on what Schools of Hope will eventually look like.
All right, Senator Simmons, this is basically just to go into conference with the House, right? We're just positioning ourselves to go into conference with the House.
That's correct.
All three proposals are now caught up in budget negotiations between the House and the Senate, and the final product is likely to include parts of all three measures. But what stays and what goes is largely unknown. And so is the price tag. The House has initially called for $200 million to fund its plan. And a lot of questions remain, like what the trade-off is for the proposal. Lawmakers have said previously the House plan would be tied to Senate President Joe Negron's bid for a water reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. But Negron would not specify what the trade-off was or is.
But we've talked all session long about the Speaker having some priorities dealing with charter school opportunities and making sure every student can succeed regardless of their financial background. Also having incentives for our best and brightest teachers to be recruited and also retained in the schools. And then I've been talking about university funding since my designation and before. And there are other issues that both sides care about. And I think it's incumbent on me as a presiding officer in the Senate to make sure that priorities that both of us share get passed in the last week.
The Senate's measure has at least one more stop in the chamber before negotiations begin on a broader Schools of Hope proposal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Lawyers for the state maintain that Governor Rick Scott had the power to reassign 23 death penalty cases to a different prosecutor after Central Florida State Attorney Aramis Ayala announced she would not seek capital punishment for defendants charged with capital crimes. Scott's lawyers made the arguments this week in response to a lawsuit filed by Ayala, who accuses the governor of usurping the Orange-Osceola prosecutor's authority by stripping her of the cases. Those cases included a high-profile case involving involving accused cop killer Markeith Lloyd. Scott reassigned the cases to Ocala area state attorney Brad King, also a defendant in Ayala's lawsuit. Ayala, who unseated former state attorney Jeff Ashton last year, argued that she based her decision on research showing the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime, is discriminatory, is costly, leaves the families of victims in limbo for too long, and is imposed on innocent people too often. Ayala and her lawyers, along with civil rights groups, ex-prosecutors, and former justices from across the state and the country, maintain that prosecutors have broad discretion in changing decisions, including whether to seek capital punishment. But in a 65-page joint response filed in the Florida Supreme Court late Wednesday of this week, lawyers for Scott and Attorney General Pam Bondi argued that Ayala's proclaimed policy of never seeking the death penalty during her time in office does not embody a traditional exercise in prosecutorial discretion. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers say creating a gambling plan may require tough compromises, but it's better than the alternative.
We maintain the position that the great expanders of gaming are really the courts, I mean the first DCA.
The legislature has approved a plan to issue special certificates to mothers who have miscarriages. The bill sponsors say they want to help families grieve, but the bill could indirectly affect abortion access.
But it's still a legal precedent that says that an unborn child is similar in relevant ways to a child after birth, which is obviously kind of something the pro-life movement wants to establish.
And the Florida Senate is now expressing its regrets to the abuse victims of the infamous Dozier School for Boys.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
A new gambling plan for the state of Florida is continuing to take shape. Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers appear determined to hammer out an agreement, saying the alternative would give the judicial system too much control.
Meeting in conference means making compromises, and Representative Jose Diaz, who is leading the House efforts, says that can be tough. The initial House plan essentially froze gambling where it is today for the next 20 years, and Diaz says many of his members are likely to push back against anything they see as an expansion, like the Senate's pitch to give paramutuals in 8 more counties the right to operate slot machines.
That has been a firm position of the House throughout the negotiation. We have not expanded to referendum counties. We are obviously very concerned about the floors in the House. If we get this to be too big.
But Diaz says if the House and Senate can't find a middle ground, he doesn't like the alternative, which would likely involve the judicial system.
We maintain the position that the great expanders of gaming are really the courts. I mean, the first DCA, the federal courts, they continue to take positions that expand gaming in Florida. And if we really want to curb gaming and we want to have thoughtful a thoughtful future for gaming in Florida, we would make some strides to expand a little so that we won't have to expand a lot.
Right now, there are a number of gambling-related cases moving through the system. One deals with the 8 counties mentioned before that held referendums approving slots locally but have been denied a license by the state to operate the machines. Which is why Senator Bill Galvano, who's leading the Senate side of the negotiations, says now is the time to act.
That's why we're doing this. I think we're in an area, we're in the eye of the storm, so to speak, in order to address these issues because decisions are pending.
As part of the negotiations, the House has agreed to a Senate proposal that would increase the length of time under the state's gambling agreement with the Seminole Tribe that the state has to respond to conflicts created by legislative or judicial action. In another response to court action, lawmakers are working to define designated player games. Galvano says that's all part of an effort to clear up any haziness in current gaming law.
There is ambiguity in the law, and that creates holes where advocates and industry representatives have been able to make arguments. And so a lot of it falls on us to make sure that we have things cleaned up.
Both Galvano and Diaz say they're encouraged by the discussion so far and hope to get an agreement finalized. The Seminole Tribe of Florida will also need to sign off on any changes to its agreement with the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida lawmakers want to issue special certificates to families who experience miscarriages. Supporters say they want to comfort grieving families, but there are concerns the bill could affect access to abortions. Kate Payne reports.
Altamont Springs Republican Representative Bob Cortez wants to help parents mourn their miscarriages.
For those of us who have lost a child, it is the most painful thing you can ever imagine. And for those of you who have your children, make sure you hug them and you tell them that you love them.
He wants the Department of Health to issue certificates of non-viable birth to families who experience a miscarriage in the first 9 to 20 weeks of pregnancy. But only if parents want it, says Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean.
It's not meant to be controversial, and I would invite all groups to look at the bill again if there's angst. It wasn't meant to be, but having met with families, it's just an option we want to make available.
A certified nurse midwife I spoke with said getting a certificate like this would be concrete evidence of the loss, and she could see how that would be comforting. But there are concerns about the intent of the bill. Some pro-choice groups worry it could reshape legal and cultural norms around fetuses.
So I think in the short term, there's not really much concern or much weight to the concerns that opponents of the bill have raised, but long term, there probably is.
That's Mary Ziegler. She teaches at the Florida State University College of Law. To be clear, Cortez says his bill isn't about abortion. It's about unintentional miscarriages.
This bill is simply about parents who lose their child, who want to memorialize them if they so wishes. Simply put, nothing more and nothing less.
And Mary Ziegler says that's accurate, but she also says skeptics should be concerned.
Both sides are right. You know, the sponsors of the bill saying there's no actual direct conflict with abortion laws are telling the truth. There isn't. But it's part of a kind of incremental strategy to establish fetal rights that in the long term could pose a threat to legal abortion.
Ziegler says the bill is not an attack on Roe versus Wade, but she says it is strategic.
So the more people believe that an unborn child is a person the same way that a child would be at 1 or 2 or 3 years old, the less cultural support there would be for an abortion right.
Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book took to the floor Thursday to say the bill isn't about fetal rights.
This has nothing to do with personhood. It rather gives families that are grieving during a very difficult time some closure, and so I want to thank you.
But Ziegler says down the road, the courts could use this kind of language as legal precedent.
So there's a long history, for example, of fetal homicide laws or wrongful death laws, other things that treat an unborn child as a person with rights outside of the abortion context. Those things, I think, from a kind of the long historical view, have made a difference to how courts view fetal life in general.
And Cortez is looking to set a new standard.
This will be the first in the nation to ever have something like this to honor the mothers who have lost their children.
The full Senate voted the bill forward Thursday. The House has already okayed it. Throughout the entire legislative process, only one lawmaker voted against the bill, Representative Richard Stark, a Weston Democrat. The measure now heads to the governor's desk. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Advocates are hopeful they'll see legislation implementing tax breaks on solar energy pass the legislature this year, but they're not happy with different parts of the House and Senate bills, as we hear from Sarah Mueller.
Amendment 4 stops cities and counties from raking in more taxes on homes or businesses because of a solar power installation. Under the Senate's proposal, Florida residents would get a 100% tax break on the improved value of their house if they buy or lease a renewable energy installation. Owners of commercial and industrial property would get an 80% tax break, and it would be the same for tangible personal property. Susan Glickman of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy says the legislation originally called for everyone to get a 100% tax exemption and argues the changes will hurt people who install solar systems.
It would raise the price of solar, and it would also be an incredible paperwork nightmare for solar contractors because you would have to have different templates for each of the 67 counties in Florida that have differing tax rates.
But bill sponsor, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandes, says he reduced the tax break from 100% to 80% to help cities and counties recoup some property tax revenue.
Our goal here is to encourage solar power. Our goal here is to encourage even large-scale solar farms so that most of us will benefit from large-scale solar farms. And this the incentive that we're offering is a 80% reduction in both tangible personal property and ad valorem taxes.
A legislative analysis shows the tax break will eventually reduce local tax revenue by more than $54 million every year. It will also reduce taxes to electric utilities. Glickman also dislikes the disclosure requirements in the House legislation, sponsored by Fort Myer Republican Representative Ray Rodriguez. She says the requirements impose barriers to companies that finance or install solar systems. Rodriguez says his measure protects consumers, but he admits the legislation uses some language from a draft proposal by Florida Power and Light, which opposed the amendment. Rodriguez's plan requires solar contractors give buyers several written disclosures, like a payment schedule, whether the solar equipment is being bought or leased, and a description of the assumptions used to calculate energy savings. The disclosures must be typed in at least 12-point size font, and violators can be fined. Bill Gallagher of the company SolarFit says it's premature to start worrying about problems in Florida's solar industry. He says he's been in business for more than 40 years with no complaints and believes the House measure is punitive.
My concern and what I want to bring forward today is the penalty clause. As I was reading through this, a penalty clause could be the price of the solar system. Excuse me, if I have the wrong font size or something like that, we could be penalized $20,000, $40,000. I just don't think that, you know, that is correct.
The Southern Alliance's Susan Glickman says she believes the Senate bill will win out in the legislature. She says Floridians expect lawmakers to implement what the voters approved.
We just want to respect the will of the voters. We want to open up the market to solar in Florida by removing barriers so people can enjoy the resource of the sun.
Senator Brandes says he'll spend the weekend negotiating with Representative Rodriguez to get a compromise bill. If signed into law, the tax breaks would start January 1st and extend until December 31st, 2037. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, last week, the Florida House formally apologized to the former wards of two now-closed reform schools for the abuse they say they suffered. Now the Florida Senate is doing the same. Sasha Cordner reports.
It begins with an apology, and I'd apologize.
That's Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam during a Florida cabinet meeting last year, apologizing to former wards of the Dozier School for Boys. The now grown men who went to the North Florida Reform School as juveniles in the 1950s and 1960s say they suffered severe beatings and sexual abuse at the hands of staffers. It took nearly a decade to bring this issue to light, and Putnam was instrumental in helping bring this issue to the cabinet in recent years.
And I don't think it takes an act of the legislature to say what needs saying, which is, you know, I'm very sorry for what these men and these generations of boys endured while wards of the state. It was unconscionable.
But the Florida legislature did decide to act this year. Last week, the Florida House formally apologized to the victims of Dozier, as well as those who say they suffered similar abuses at its sister campus in Okeechobee. House Speaker Richard Corcoran has made this one of his priorities this year. He calls the apology a, quote, minimum first step.
I cannot say with enough heartfelt remorse that it's taken this long for a legislature with all the evidence that is before us to come forth and apologize for what has to be one of the blackest moments on our state's history. And as much as we apologize for the grave injustice that was done to these now men but young children, we hope that there'll be some degree of healing and closure that can take place, knowing that it's being recognized. But the most important part is that it never happens again to anybody else at any time in our state's history.
And Wednesday, the Florida Senate followed suit with an apology of its own. As with the House resolution, Dozier survivors and their families watched from the Senate gallery as St. Petersburg Democrat Daryl Rusan read the apology.
This resolution declares that the Senate regrets the treatment of children at Dozier School for Boys, that it was cruel, unjust, and a violation of human decency, and acknowledges this shameful past of our state's history. This resolution, on behalf of the Senate, apologizes to these men yet living, to the boys known and unknown in their remains. We say to you, we apologize. We are sorry.
The reformed school survivors were also individually recognized, and after all the senators signed on to co-sponsor the apology expressing their regret, they gave a standing ovation.
Those of you who are with us today, we say again, we're sorry.
And so all those now in favor of the resolution signify by saying yay.
Yay.
Show the resolution adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Rusan.
Meanwhile, the House has passed a bill which includes memorials in Tallahassee and Marianna for the boys believed to have died from the abuse and were buried in unmarked graves on the grounds. Through DNA matches, University of South Florida researchers in recent years helped reunite some of the 55 remains they unearthed with the boys' descendants. Many of the Dozier survivors, including Jerry Cooper, also helped to get that bill passed. Cooper is the head of the so-called White House Boys, named for the building where former wards say a lot of the abuse occurred.
A lot of the men, the White House Boys, a lot of them have passed over the last 3 to 4 years. I hope this closure comes as quickly as it can, because we, like I said, we don't have that kind of time.
Kim Case with Holland and Knight has helped represent the White House Boys through this legislative process. She says with no Senate companion, she's working to see if the Senate will take up the House Memorial Bill, expected to cost $1.5 million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us every weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from the Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition, protection, and stewardship of public and private conservation lands to protect Florida's waters, and to Everglades Restoration and Fish and Wildlife Conservation, the Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.